we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Centre for Public Christianity, this is Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
It was impressive, yes. There was a roll guard of girls at the entrance. All the staff were there and beaming and shaking our hands and being very welcoming. And we were placed in the centre of the large celebration. I guess there were several hundreds there and officially welcomed. It was a bit more than we anticipated.
That's Robert Banks. He and his wife Linda have written a book about Amy Oxley Wilkinson, a young Australian who went to China as a missionary in 1895 and had an incredible life there. Here Rob is describing how he and Linda became VIPs at a large celebration at the School for the Blind in China that Amy established while she was there. The school still operates, and her memory lives on, and being connected in this way to Amy, having written the book, the Banks were treated with great honour when they visited the school in Fuzhou, now a major institution in Fujian province.
One of the most fascinating surprises was seeing a picture of her at the entrance to the school and a little description of who she was and what she had done. And she is still remembered, still talked about, and the whole spirit that she injected into the place is still very evident, even to them.
Rob and Linda's book is called They Shall See His Face. It's a missionary story. Missionaries are not always very popular these days. But let's hear her story. Today on Life and Faith, Rob and Linda Banks recounting the life and legacy of Amy Oxley Wilkinson. She was from a line of famous Australians, the great-granddaughter of the colonial chaplain, Samuel Marsden, and the granddaughter of the explorer, John Oxley.
Amy grew up in the what we now describe as the western suburbs of Sydney, out near Camden. She was a country girl, really, so she learnt to ride and she learnt to shoot, and she enjoyed time with her family in Victoria, who also had a big property, and she would come and go from there. She eventually moved closer to the city as her father sold the property, which is actually the property they were living on, is Kirkham, which has now become the setting for the Australian soapy place called Home. The house is actually not contemporary to the period when Amy was there, but that's the property that she grew up on. Eventually, she went to train at the a hospital for sick children, where she learnt a whole lot of skills that would be ultimately very useful in China.
Now, none of this is very close to China in any sense. So, Rob, where does that come from, this interest in China?
I think she got interested partly at school, doing a little bit of study on China, but then the family also had, through relatives, connections with Chinese in the city. But it was mainly, I think, through visitors from overseas, some heavy hitters like Hudson Taylor, who started a whole lot of missionary work in China from the 1860s. George Grubb, who came from another organisation, the Church Missionary Society in England, and stirred up people's interest. And then finally, Robert Stewart, who was a working highly regarded missionary in Fuzhou province at the time, and put out the call to interest others from Australia to come and join him.
Now, I'm trying to imagine the life of a young woman in late 19th century Sydney, and this sense of calling to go to China that she obviously felt. Was this a dread thing, or was it a bit of an adventure? Was she excited by the prospect?
I think it was a bit of both, probably. I think she was a highly spirited young woman. She was the first woman to go from New South Wales with the Church Missionary Society to China. So it was an adventure in that sense, though she had to face the fact that her good friends who'd gone from Victoria had actually just recently been killed in a very horrible murder.
The horrible murder that Linda is referring to occurred in July 1895. Amy learned about this a week after it happened. Her soon-to-be colleagues, Robert and Louisa Stewart, and their young children, along with two sisters from Melbourne, Nellie and Topsy Saunders, and four other missionaries, had been brutally murdered near Kuchang. These were friends of Amy, people she wrote to often. She was supposed to be working with them. The world was horrified by the event. It was big news at the time. The missionaries had retreated to the small mountain village of Huaisang to escape the summer heat. And they were met by a militant local group. It was a movement that believed that foreigners were overturning age-old traditions upon which Chinese culture had been built, affecting even simple food they once ate. They believed this offended ancestral gods and disturbed the natural order. So about 80 men marched up to the house that the missionaries were in and murdered them all and burnt the house to the ground. Amazingly, despite the shock of this news and the clear message that not all foreigners were welcome in China, Amy decided to go anyway.
I think she and others who were also preparing to go, she would have gone to that very same spot if had she have gone a year earlier. I think it made them more determined that these women had laid down their lives for something important and they needed to come and fill those shoes.
It's an interesting perspective when you have that kind of a view of something like this, where you're willingly going into at least a very difficult situation and perhaps perilous.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we know the end of the story. But she didn't at the time. But she had a strong conviction that this was right for her at this time in her life, that she had a lot to offer. And she loved Chinese people back here in Sydney. And as we'll go on to say, she really grew to love Chinese people very much and was involved with them her whole life.
Well, tell us about the China that she leaves on a boat to get to. What's it like? What sort of environment is it?
It's still much as it was for centuries, but beginning to become a little more modern, a little more affected by other influences from outside. And she sees a bit of that in the big city, Fuzhou, but then she goes up country and moves into a small village of just a few thousand people and sees it firsthand, just out the door, all around her, some of the great needs, lots of sick people, no hospital until she and others came. Education was only for a few boys here and there and not at all for girls. And so that was something that she and others wanted to do something about. There were some real social problems. Infanticide, particularly of girls, was a regular occurrence, a somewhat horrific one. Opium addiction was hitting families hard and often causing poverty and other issues. So she's thrown in out the front door, just a few feet away every day into this, and along with the two other Australian women she was with, just begins to respond to it.
And she's responding to that need by doing what? What's she providing for the people there?
Well, she initially was a nurse, so every day there would be hundreds of people lined up at their local dispensary within the missionary compound who would come for all kinds of needy situations. The doctor was hundreds and hundreds of miles away servicing very many compounds, and so Amy really was it when it came to medicine within their own little Leon Kong area, as it was called.
It's fascinating to me that she sees this terrible poverty around her and what she described as joylessness, and women shut up in houses and experiencing ill health and oppression of various kinds. And her immediate reaction is to say, these people need to know Jesus. Now, what's the connection? I'm interested in this. Someone might well ask, well, you know, they don't need Jesus. They need someone to help them.
Oh, she's doing both. It's obvious that the physical and other needs before her have to be met, and that's something that's done out of love, inspired by Jesus, really. But as part of that, you just tell the story of where that love came from and why you came to China and why you think Jesus is somebody who anybody anywhere in the world might have an interest in. The people, in many respects, are terribly bound by superstitions which hold them back. Even from going to places or doing things, binding their female children's feet so that they'll somehow be more attractive to others.
And ghosts.
And ghosts were there. Causing huge amount of anxiety and fear on a daily basis. To lift that fear, to give them hope, Jesus just moves into this. It's just a normal part of the conversation. And not just words which these people hear, but they can actually see a difference in people like her, which gives them just a new way of looking at possibilities in life.
She clearly sees the Christian vision of human life and human activity as liberating, and saw that as something she could bring to the people there.
Definitely, and not something that she was wanting to impose on them either. It's very much an offer, sharing stories, just sharing life, and let these people make of it what they wish. If they're attracted to it, we can talk and find out more. If not, well, that's fine. I'm not going to press you or manipulate you in any way to what I believe.
You're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. Today I'm bringing you an interview with Robert and Linda Banks, authors of They Shall See His Face, a book about Amy Oxley Wilkinson, an Australian missionary to China in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Amy Oxley Wilkinson founded a school for blind children in Fujian province that still operates today. In 1920, the president of the new Chinese Republic awarded her the Order of the Golden Grain, the highest honour a foreigner could receive. I asked Linda Banks, what was Amy Oxley Wilkinson finding in her work that drove her to action, particularly on behalf of poor blind children, and to start a school for them?
She's seeing children who have no future, really. She met some who had been taken... She encountered some who were actually with their parents and begged her to come and look after them because they had no money, they had no facilities. Blindness, it would seem to be, was a real issue and still is in China for all kinds of reasons, some to do with poverty, some to do with diet, which is related, and something to do with the Asian eye, apparently. Whatever the case, many of these children were absolutely scarred for life, were unable to have a future apart from perhaps being a beggar. And so when she first encountered these children, she thought, I can't do anything. But eventually there seemed to be an erosion of her heart, really, towards them. Until one day, as she was walking from one village to another, she encountered this child who had a boy who'd been left in a ditch, a semi-grave by his father. And she realised she just could not escape. She had to do something about it. She had some skills. She knew that she was in it for the long term because a child like that needs a future and you've got to provide some kind of employment for them. But she made that decision.
In my homeland, I had passed the blind on the other side of the street, for I had no special interest in them. Now my heart was stirred to its depths on many occasions when blind children were brought to me in our dispensary. What could I do? The answer I received from a small boy when I asked how he received a bruise on his face. Oh, my uncle just struck me in the face and said, "Get out of my way, you blind boy." Going to a village one day, I stumbled across a helpless blind boy cowering in a ditch. He told me his father had wanted to kill him, but seeing I was coming, had left him for me. An appeal made to me by a woman for her only son in the little mission church of Liang Kong. He is my only son. I am a widow and he is blind. Do good deeds, open his eyes, and give him to see. Alas, his sight was beyond restoring, and the fact left a lasting impression on my mind. To be blind is a terrible thing. To be blind of poor Chinese parentage is still more terrible. My sympathy was drawn out as I thought about them being blind of God's beauteous world around, and blind of heaven's own light.
So, after visiting a school for the blind in Amoy province, Amy took on the task herself. She rented a tiny house in one of the dirty streets of Deng Doi. It contained a room 2 feet by 8 feet, just long enough for a table and 2 chairs. Her schoolroom. On either side was a bedroom 8 feet by 10 feet, and outside a shed, which served as a kitchen and dining room combined. She hired a cook and opened her school for the blind, initially with one boy. That first boy was Ling Kai. He was the only son of the widow who had earlier appealed for her help. Robert Banks explains the impact Amy was able to have on her students as more arrived to be taught and cared for. By 1913, there were 80 boys at the school, and Amy carried on the work even when she was married and had her own 2 children to care for.
Well, just one example, Lin Kai, who was one of the earliest children to come to her, I think he was aged around 6 or 7 or 8 at the time, and within 6 weeks he's reading Braille. Not long after, he's actually translating documents into Braille out of his knowledge of English, which he's been taught. He's beginning to shepherd some of the even younger children and helping them to sort of find their way in this very small initial school that she set up. He begins to learn how to use his hands to make things, to weave, to create baskets, to make furniture. And this gets sold, and so it produces more money for the institution so that people can have food on the table and she can actually feed the boys. He just continues to learn life skills, not just how to manufacture things, which can provide a job later, full employment, but also how to actually teach. He becomes a teacher. He is engaged in education, full employment in that sense as well.
It's a very human account, this book. You get a real sense of her frustrations and fears as well as her joys, and a real sense that she had a deep love for the people there.
Most definitely. She was constantly broke. The school just every month would just make it, and a lot of Australian people helped to contribute towards the school. She had, you know, a bit like a World Vision Child program going back there in the early tens. In Australia as well. You can imagine the therapies that the teachers and students were involved in was very close. You had to have someone talking to you saying, that is red, or, you know, defining reality for you. So there's a lot of very close
contact
and, yeah, and a lot of different therapies which involved physical contact with, like music, for example, was one very big one that she used. She was very musical herself. And so the school produced all kinds of musicians. It was a full-on job, 24/7. She was with these kids. Even when she married and had her own family, they were exhausting.
Well, not the normal missionary story. She's on the mission field and does meet someone who becomes her husband.
Yeah, I don't think she ever expected that would be the case, but it's a very nice story. She meets when the school starts out in this little village that Robert was talking about, but then ultimately it gets so big she has to move it into the capital, into Fuzhou. And so in the process of doing that, she moves it to the hospital, which makes sense. The new doctor turns up from England, who'd been working with for 10 years in the slums of the East End. And his name is Dr. George Wilkinson, a Cambridge graduate who'd encountered these Cambridge Seven and had been influenced back there to go to China. He'd been preparing for those 10 years to give his whole life to China. And she starts working with him.
One thing led to another. And tell us about that connection, that partnership. So they work well together. She's running the school. He's running the local hospital. Both things are firsts for that region. And they're good at their work. It's not all smooth sailing, though, is it?
No, I mean, there's always financial struggles for a start for the hospital and the blind school. There are things they can do to help each other. He keeps an eye on the medical side of things so far as the health of the kids were concerned in the blind school. And she provides through the blind school increasingly people who can spend time with patients, who can talk with them, who can write letters for them, who can read books to them, strangely enough, although they're blind, who can help them understand what the Bible says if they're interested in that and Jesus and God and all of that kind of thing. So there's an intermix between the two. And often all of them get caught up in wider, bigger issues which hit the whole city and province. I mean, every year almost typhoid is a problem. Almost every second or third year, cholera is a problem, killing people to the right, to the left, hundreds of people at a time. And so they all get caught up, overwhelmed by, but nevertheless helping people in the city come to terms with these terrific natural disasters.
Now, it's fair to say these days the missionary enterprise is not looked upon by people in the 21st century all that glowingly. People have real reservations about this and fear that there was a kind of intermingling of missionaries with the colonial project. There's a kind of condescending element to this and perhaps even destructive element of local cultures. When you think about Amy particularly, what would you say in response to that sort of perspective and what in fact she was like?
Fascinating thing about her is how much she builds on the local culture in all sorts of ways. She knows what has been or has not been done with respect to the blind. She certainly steps in and does things which have not been done before and which get notice and accolades from all sorts of people at all sorts of levels in the city. But she also builds on what had been happening with the blind. Just one example, the whole musical development in the school, which led to the creation of various bands, bands which went on tours within the city, within the province, within the nation, eventually overseas to the UK. That's something that's firmly built on the Chinese tradition of blind boys in particular being street musicians. She sees the options, the possibilities, and builds on them there. The school she builds in the Chinese style, it's a Chinese building. They continue to eat and live in all sorts of ways which are recognisably Chinese and part of the culture. She prepares the children to enter into the culture and add to the benefit and welfare of the culture through the employment that she provides for them and in all sorts of other ways, which ultimately gets the notice of scholars in the city, business people in the city, government officials in the city, and leads to her being recommended for the highest award that any foreigner could be given in China for what she's contributed to China.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing really, isn't it? And perhaps a great indicator that unlike perhaps some of the missionaries that we might imagine didn't have that level of respect for local culture, she's clearly won people over with the work that she did and the way that she went about it.
I think the other thing is that they didn't live, Amy and George, and the hospital and the blind school were not within the missionary compound. It was outside, it was in the city. So they were as open to being devastated by typhoons and have disease and so on like anyone else. They lived with the people. And I think that was deeply respected by all the different levels within Chinese culture. Like you had the various Confucianists and other literati who were saying, who came together on recognising Amy because they realised she was an asset to their community and they should have been doing something themselves.
And both the hospital and the school were positioned at the North Gate, one of the four main entrances to the city. So it was one of the first things people encountered coming in from the countryside, as they often did, so that the work that both did became known not just within the city itself, but within the whole province as people came and went on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis. In fact, the two of them, Amy and George, were often itinerating to villages, to other towns, provincial cities, in all sorts of very positive and helpful ways.
Did she look back on this experience as a positive one? How did she assess her impact and her experience?
Well, according to her family, who have some stories, yes, she was. Like, for example, there is a story told in about 1944 when she was in the East End of London with her grandson, and they went into a Chinese restaurant, and the whole restaurant stood up, and she spoke to them in Chinese. She was involved with their lives. She loved Chinese people. It was almost, that's who she was, you know. She was English. Well, she was Australian and English, and now, but this part of China was in her heart. She only came home. They only came home because of their children's education and all sorts of difficulties back there. And then, of course, the doors were firmly slammed shut in 49-50.
Yes, so the Communist Party comes to power in 1949. Missionaries aren't particularly welcome from that point onwards. But the school survives.
Yes, yes. And it is an impressive place. Very impressive. In fact, one of the wonderful stories is that in 1980, when he was governor of Fuzhou, Xi Jinping, the current Chinese president, gave money to support the school and to build the next stage of development. One of the wonderful things Robert didn't say at the beginning, when we went to the White Cane Day, one of the great hits of the whole day was watching the blind boys play football. And some of Amy's family playing with them. It was a great experience. In fact, that football team was in the Paralympics.
In Rio. And won the bronze
and
medal.
And they did, yes. Right. So yes, it's very much part of the community within Fuzhou.
They're also very proud that one of their students had won the X Factor in China that year and was a nationally known figure. So. Yeah.
This has been Life and Faith with Rob and Linda Banks' story of the missionary Amy Oxley Wilkinson and her school for the blind in China. The book is called They Shall See His Face. It's out now. If you enjoyed this conversation, we've got plenty more on our website, publicchristianity.org. And of course, there's a new conversation on Life and Faith each week. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week.
After I finished my PhD at Cambridge, this kind of idea of academic success continued to pay off, as it were. I was elected to a junior research fellowship at the University of Oxford. And a few months into my time there, my friends and I heard that very famous atheist philosopher known as Peter Singer was coming to give a series of lectures. So we're really excited, and a bunch of us went to go and hear Singer's lectures. The lectures were on the topic of ethics, in other words, do we have any kind of duties to other people? And it tapped into, like more broadly speaking, it tapped into the issue of human worth. Like, so in other words, the question of, well, do human lives have any value? So I quite happily went on to these lectures really excited because Peter Singer is sort of a very famous philosopher, and I was expecting that as an atheist, I'd sort of be hearing exactly the kind of ethics that I subscribe to. But actually what I heard was really, it just floored me, to be honest.